We just recorded an awesome episode with Andy Carvel, co-founder of Feature Mobile Growth Agency, who was an early employee at SoundCloud a few years ago. Yeah, it was an amazing discovery. How did you find him?
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, he's a bit of a legend anyway, that from he invented the mobile growth stack that people might have heard of, and we kind of speak about that for a bit. But
Yeah.
just so much interesting stuff about retention and the things that they did at SoundCloud, and we kind of go deep in mobile kind of push notifications and general retention and
Yeah.
segmentation. And it was awesome. We could have carried on for a lot longer. So I think we're definitely getting back at some point.
Yeah, no, if you like us, if you still like SoundCloud, you'll find it very interesting. If you like retention, life cycle, push notification, like improving retention, app to drive growth, you'll definitely like it. And also, yes, he was also developing mobile games on Nokia 3310s back in 1999, 2000, and that is a
That was
baller.
crazy.
That is a
That
baller fact.
that
So he
was
didn't.
amazing.
What's the game he developed? I forgot that. Was it
It
like
was Space Impact, the little
Space
side-scrolling
Impact?
like rocket shooting game. As soon as he said it, I was like, "Damn, I remember that!" And I googled it. And as soon as I saw the first picture that comes up on Google Images, I was like, "Holy shit! We're talking to
So
the
he
guy that literally developed one of the first mobile games."
that's mad, and his mate made Snake,
Yeah.
which, like, for most people around our age listening to this podcast would have played.
Yeah, man, best game ever.
I think I filled in the screen maybe in those years, maybe once or twice, but I was really bad at it, at actually finishing the whole screen and finishing the game. But
Crazy. That game was madness. That would like it was like that generation's Candy Crush. It's probably not as popular as Candy Crush, but it was like the game that everybody played.
yeah, no, Snake was much better. Fuck Candy Crush.
Yeah, I hate Candy Crush. And it wasn't monetized. It was free.
It was free. It was just the time where the game was just like a few pixels moving around, and simple task. No fancy shit in your screen or money to be spent to get an extra life or
Exactly.
an exclusive skin.
That's the most exciting thing. You get a new phone, you'd be like, "Oh, what's the games on this?"
Pre-installed games. But anyway, so that was a great chat. I'm glad we connected with him, and hope you like this episode.
Enjoy, guys.
Peace. Hey, buddy.
Hey, man. These late night recordings are like the Hollyoaks adult edition that's on at like 10 o'clock at night.
Don't know what
Do you
that
even know what that is? No.
No.
I don't even know if it's a thing anymore. It used to be a soap, and it was like on at normal soap time, like a EastEnders. But
was
then
gonna say
one night
it's
a week
like
they did like a late adult version.
a. I was gonna say it's more like a past midnight re-edition of the Bob Ross painting session.
Your references are always significantly cooler than mine.
Can't help it.
It gets to 8 o'clock and I feel like it's midnight.
Yeah.
Anybody with
Man.
kids listening will hopefully understand that.
It's not easy running a podcast. Finding the time, but we're doing it.
We are.
A few days ago, we were top two marketing podcasts in the UK.
Yeah, man. Thanks to your hard work in the Apple stores.
Man, this technique is blows my mind. It's working every time, and I think we're gonna do it more often. That's the plan, at least.
Shout out to the people that have been organically posting about the podcast this last couple of weeks on
Yeah,
LinkedIn.
that too.
It's
That
been
too.
really
That
cool to see that.
Yeah. It's been quite a few posts actually from people. Keep doing that, guys. That's really cool. That's really cool.
It gives us
Knowing
the
what,
encouragement to carry on.
Yeah. No, that's been also. I felt it too. Like, I mean, we both saw it. Like, we both on the comments, like two piranhas on the on our LinkedIn. Every time there is like a notification that comes up, it's like, ooh, someone talked about the podcast. Both of us were like, yeah. Oh yeah, thank you. It's so it's
funny. No comment gets left behind.
Yeah, no comment but left behind. Who are we talking to today? Before he arrives, we're talking to Andy, who from Berlin, who has been in growth for many years, and has worked at Spotify. Scrap that.
Uh-oh. I cut that out.
Cut that out. That's been working at SoundCloud a few years ago as a senior growth PM in the retention team. I think some like new market lead as well. I think it was the 2014, 2016 type years. We both really like SoundCloud because we're both into music. I don't know when you started using SoundCloud, but I started using SoundCloud like a long time ago, like maybe 2010, 2011, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that. I've used it kind of on and off through like the years.
The Tumblr era in those days. But I looked it up because I didn't know, but SoundCloud started in 2007. Their existing logo, or the logo that everyone knows them about, knows them for, started in 2010.
Mm.
And they apparently, according to the internet, they've got 175 million monthly active users. So
they're definitely considered an early stage startup.
No, but most people consider SoundCloud as like either niche or you know, old school. But it's a shit ton of people, you know, like
it's a lot of
millions. So Andy was working there for a few years. We're gonna talk about that, and then went on to start his mobile growth agency in Berlin for the last 6 years or something. And we'll talk about that too. And yeah, should be a nice chat. I'm really curious about what he's done at SoundCloud based on, I guess, my own experience of using SoundCloud from back in the days, being like a niche kind of, you know, do your own thing, underground type of music platform, discovering like new artists and stuff.
Yeah, hopefully we can get some good, we can dig into that stuff. He's actually Fitcher, which is agency, they put together the mobile growth stack that I've actually referenced tons of times over the years, which is, for anyone that hasn't seen it, we can ask him about it later on, but for anyone that hasn't seen it, it's like a kind of tooling / strategy stack for growing. It's like a framework for mobile growth. So it's really cool. It's really nice to include in presentations and pretend that it's your own.
Yeah, you can.
I don't think I've ever done that. I've always credited.
You can admit that to him.
He's in the lobby if we want to bring him in.
Yeah, let's do it.
Andy.
Hey, hey. Jake. How are you on?
Hey, man. How are you doing?
Doing very well, thanks.
Welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Nice.
A pleasure. We were talking before you joined. We were talking a little bit about our experiences with the past with SoundCloud, and and like reminiscing a little bit of that time. I was trying to remember which year I started using it, but it must have been around 2010, 2011, like early days, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice.
And I was really keen for us to spend a bit on time of time on that and your experience there, then, because it's a really cool platform. A lot of people know about it. I don't think there's been, from what I've seen, a lot of this like talks about growth at SoundCloud from those years when you were there. And then move on to the last few years with Feature, with your agency, and talk about that a little bit as well, if that's okay.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Andy, should we start with an intro? Just give us your kind of potted backstory and any kind of interesting bits about you and your career and things you've done. That would be great.
Yeah, sure. So hi, I'm Andy Carvel. I'm a co-founder and partner at Feature these days, which is a mobile growth consultancy. In my past, I was working at SoundCloud on growth, leading various teams there. Before I left, I was leading the retention team at SoundCloud. I'm mostly focusing on growing their mobile presence. And prior to that, I was in the early days of the mobile games industry. I guess right at the start of it, I was at Nokia back in 1999, developing embedded games for their 3310 handset. It was, I think, the first handset that I worked on. Made a game called Space Impact, which is one of the first arcade scrolling shoot 'em up games on a mobile.
I know that game. I played that game in those days, in those phones. Yeah. Wait, did you do the Snake too?
No, I didn't do Snake. That was a guy called Tanali something or other. I forget his name, so I'm not going to try and pronounce it. But it was a guy in Finland who wrote Snake, and basically off the back of that success, because suddenly it was like everyone was talking about Snake and everyone was playing it. So Nokia invested a lot. They in their new R&D facility in the UK. That's where I'm from. They created a games team, and I was one of the first members of that games team.
So cool. Basically, Andy, you were one of the forefathers of mobile gaming. That's what you're telling us.
You could put it that way, I guess.
Yeah, I think you can legit claim that title. That's amazing.
I was in. I was in mobile games then, as mobile games became a thing and it became a term. I was in that industry making games for a couple of different companies, sort of that moved to a studio down on the south coast of England called IOMO that was getting a lot of the sort of IP for sort of quite interesting licenses like Fight Club, I think I worked on, Wheel of Fortune, things like that. And was in the games industry, sort of slowly getting more into the publishing side and a bit of further away from development. Then eventually, moved to Berlin after doing a short stint to do my MBA at the Warwick Business School in the UK. And ended up in Berlin and joined SoundCloud there in 2012, February.
Wow. And still in Berlin to this day.
And still in Berlin. Yes, that's it's where I set up Feature. It's also where I met my co-founder, Moritz. He was working with us at SoundCloud. We set up Feature in Berlin as well. Yeah.
Cool. So it's a great city to live in for sure.
Yeah, I like it here.
Really nice. How did you come across SoundCloud in those days from where you from being, I guess, already at the time a legend on mobile gaming and moving into like quite a new thing at the time, right? Like, independent music artist platform.
Yeah, so I came to Berlin at least partially because of the techno music scene. I really like techno. I really like music, and there's a lot of electronic music on SoundCloud. So it was kind of around the same time that I ended up in Berlin when I was just writing my thesis, actually in an ad tech company called SponsorPay. I was writing my thesis to finish my MBA, decided basically during that 10 weeks of that thesis project that I definitely wanted to stay in Berlin. The music scene here is just like next level. I think around that same time, I kind of encountered SoundCloud. I wasn't a heavy user before I joined them, but I think I already had an account. And it just happened. But when I decided, okay, I'm not going back to the UK, I'm staying in Berlin, I started looking around who was hiring here, and SoundCloud was definitely one of the bigger startups in Berlin and one of the more successful ones back in 2012. And they just happened to be hiring for somebody to help them grow on mobile. I think the job title was product marketing manager for mobile. Their marketing team was hiring. They were looking for somebody with mobile experience and ideally with an MBA. It said MBA preferred. And I literally just done that. So yeah, it was kind of like, okay, boom, let's try this. And yeah, after a few interviews, I managed to get in.
Amazing. Nice. Just a quick detour on that one. Did you feel that having the MBA, like, did you put that to use, or was it a good way to get in the door and then it was just like immediately irrelevant, or?
Yeah, great question, Jake. Like, I get asked that, you know, periodically, you know, would I recommend, for example, somebody else to do an MBA? Because they've kind of gone out of fashion, I think, particularly for entrepreneurs and startup people. It's definitely not a necessity. What I can say, I can only speak from my own experience. Everyone's experience is different. But for me, it was a real game changer. I did a 12-month intensive MBA. So 1 year intensive. Was very intensive, but that's how I like to work anyway. Like, you know, it gave me in that year, like, tons of knowledge, much broader than, you know, the game development knowledge that I had before. So I got a lot of exposure to a lot of different areas of, you know, business theory and economic theory, as well as like a lot of very practical skills out of it, like, you know, being able to present in front of people, which, you know, I was a nerdy, shy programmer when I started the MBA, and probably still not the best presenter in the world, but I definitely kind of, it gets you over a lot of things, builds a lot of confidence, you know, also just like the practical skills of like writing CVs, you know, sort of being able to sort of sell yourself, interview skills, that kind of stuff as well. These sort of career development skills really gave me the confidence to, first of all, to move to Berlin. And second of all, it got me in the door at SoundCloud because it said MBA preferred. So it kind of got me at least to probably close to the top of the pile, you know, for an interview. But it also gave me the skills to actually, like, you know, get the job, I think, in terms of like, you know, my capability to conduct myself in those interviews. And then when I was in the job, I would say it really, I guess the main thing which the MBA really brought me was the sort of exposure to a lot of business frameworks. And it was during my time at SoundCloud and out of a lot of frustration, frankly, in like trying to get stuff done and trying to help explain to the rest of the company and to my superiors at SoundCloud, like what the hell mobile growth was all about and what did it take to grow a mobile app, that I came up with this framework called the Mobile Growth Stack, which actually ended up, I published that and it ended up being quite famous, and it kind of, what actually led me to start Feature. So it's a very long-winded answer of saying, yes, for me, it was incredibly helpful. I think I wouldn't be in Berlin today. I would never have worked at SoundCloud, and I wouldn't have come up with the Mobile Growth Stack, which is actually the foundation of the business that I built here in Berlin.
That's really interesting. Yeah, but just before you joined, I was saying to Yo that the Mobile Growth Stack, I've referenced it so many times, and I'm going to admit I've included it in presentations. I've never said I made
Amazing.
It. I've always included the logo, but I think it's so good. I kind of introed it to anyone who hadn't heard of it before, but I mean, maybe if you want to quickly talk about what that is, if piqued anyone's interest.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So the Mobile Growth Stack, it actually came about just as I mentioned, like as a way of trying to explain what my job was to everyone else at SoundCloud. And it was really about trying to put everything onto one page in a sort of easily digestible form. What are the levers for growth on mobile? Like, what does it take to grow a mobile app? What could be the components of a mobile growth strategy? And, you know, I really feel like the strategy is really all about being selective and having focus and deciding what to focus on and what to, you know, to discard. What's either not relevant or you're going to maybe look at it later. And what it does is it gives you that one page cheat sheet as anybody who wants to grow a mobile app, a mobile marketer, or, you know, a founder is building a mobile product, gives you that kind of overview of like everything that you could do to grow your mobile app, all of the kind of key activities in acquisition, engagement and retention, monetization, analytics, etc. And I think one of the common misconceptions with the framework is, oh shit, I've got to do all of these things. There's like 50 things on this page. It's not about that. It's really about, you know, giving you the overview so you can consider the whole. and then drill down and focus on the things which make the most sense for your business at that particular point in time. And then to the sort of keep track of like what you're doing well and be able to add on additional capabilities over time while sort of keeping track of like, you know, all of the things you could be doing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, there you go.
I just realized as well, by the way, that's a, you know, I'm connecting the dots as we talk, that I actually also saw your stack and probably used it when I was at Depop in 2018. And I completely forgot.
Nice.
And now you're talking about it. And I'm like, this is the guy. this is the stack I used. Prioritize things. Oh, gosh.
Amazing.
That makes sense. Okay, so now we're like, we're in it. That's fine. Like, that makes sense. All connects. It all connects. That's amazing. That's great. Well, thank you for that, Andy. That was really helpful. Yep. In those years.
No problem. Thanks for using it. Hope it was helpful. Yeah.
I want to kind of go back a little bit in the SoundCloud days. Mm-hmm. Before we maybe reconnect with what you do now at the agency. How big was SoundCloud at the time when you joined? Do you remember?
I think I was employee number 89, if I recall. Definitely sort of, it was below 100. And I think by the time I left in 2016, we were about 300 and something.
Okay. Okay. Mm. Nice. And in terms of users, do you have an idea?
Yeah. Let me think back. I think we had about 50 million monthly actives. Again, by the time I left, I think it was kind of probably closer to 100 million. Yeah. So I think sort of over the time I was there, I probably went from sort of sub 50 million to like closer to 100 million. But I'm struggling to remember the specific numbers.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It was in that region. It was yeah, definitely yeah. already had some decent traction when I joined. Most of those users were on web back then. You know, it's kind of my job to kind of help them take advantage of a trend that they were already seeing towards more usage of the mobile products, and to really help them to capitalize on that.
I saw some of the, so I know it was a few years ago now, but it's quite fascinating to, it's not that far away as well, in terms of, you know, I mean, how many years we're talking about. It's quite interesting to understand that it was mostly web. That's how I remember SoundCloud back in those days as well. Like I was using on the browser. How did I guess the one of the questions I have is, what do you remember? Was the most impactful thing that you've done, or maybe things that you've seen being maybe the other way around as well, like the biggest challenge moving from web to mobile, from what you can remember, obviously.
Yeah, sure. Let's start with like the impactful stuff, because I guess those things kind of stick out in my memory a little more. Then we can come back to the some of the challenges of migrating from web to mobile. Because I can definitely speak to both of those, but impactful stuff. I think a real game changer was when we realized how much, excuse my language, but how much fucking traffic we had on mobile web. So like SoundCloud had a really nice kind of like web 2.0 web desktop web app. They had a sort of a simpler, but still pretty decent mobile web app that was relatively, didn't have all of the features of the desktop web, but it was, you know, it had a decent mobile web player. Which was most important, actually, because a lot of the growth came from SEO, like all of the tracks being indexed, etc. So a lot of traffic was hitting web was via Google. You know, like it was not people always just coming to SoundCloud.com and searching. Mm-hmm. Actually, most of the searching happened on Google, because actually the SoundCloud search was pretty shit. They won't mind me saying that. I think it's got better, but it's still possibly easier to find your track if you search on Google for it and put SoundCloud at the end rather than searching on using the internal search.
Interesting.
And so there was a ton of traffic, relatively low intent traffic, like or intent to maybe listen to a single track, you know, landing on the website. And increasingly, people were accessing that website through their mobile devices, because that was just that was just the wave that was, you know, just hitting, you know, everyone was getting smartphones. And so a lot of that traffic was coming via mobile web. And, you know, when we looked at the data, we saw, you know, these people that were landing maybe via Google or maybe coming directly like on mobile web and listening to a track, they would listen to one track and then they would bounce. You know, they were there just for that piece of content. Whereas if we knew that if we got them into the mobile, the native mobile app, they were way more sticky, and we could actually get them to create an account, and, you know, they would have a, you know, much more high likelihood of actually being a retained and engaged user over the long term. Mm-hmm. So I think coming to the realization, like, there's a shit ton of traffic hitting mobile web that we're not really, you know, if we're just letting them stay there and listen to that track, you know, we're missing a trick, really. So when we decided to, you know, hit those users up with a pop-up once the user started playing the track, so they could still listen to the track on mobile web, but then they would get like an interstitial saying, hey, why don't you download the mobile app here, you get a better mm-hmm. experience, blah blah blah. You know, obviously we tested some different CTAs, etc. But nice. Frankly, regardless of what CTA we use, just having that in front of, you know, what was like millions of users a week was driving such an insane amount of traffic to the app store, of which, you know, a decent amount was converting, which got more as we optimized the app store pages better. But that fire hose of traffic was fantastic. First of all, it just like allowed us to just scale much quicker up the rankings on the app stores, which got a lot more visibility. It's kind of like a virtuous circle. You know, the more installs you get, the higher up the rankings you go. And so it was just like, it was also a great place for testing stuff, because we had this, this constant like flow of users, like many of whom had, you know, they were seeing SoundCloud for the first time. So it was also a great pool of users to test with. We actually built a whole kind of fake app store page so that we could do ASO testing directly on like with users who are coming from mobile web, show them a fake version of the app store page, which later became like products that they were commercialized products that did exactly that, like Test Nest and Stormhaven. That used to be their whole business model, but back then there wasn't that stuff. So especially my colleague Moritz, my co-founder Moritz, who built that at SoundCloud, and that was kind of a game changer. And then I guess, you know, another kind of game changing moment in terms of growth, more on the retention side, was when we built out a proper push notification service and started sending push notifications personalized to users' listening history, you know, to actually recommend content and to reactivate users when they hadn't been on the app for a few days, and just sort of, you know, kind of providing them more content and giving them more reasons to come back and listen. That was a huge increase in retention for us.
And was the challenge at that time acquisition or retention, or maybe both? But
you know what, I would say it was probably more retention, and that's why I was very happy to take the role of retention lead when we kind of restructured the way we were looking at growth, and we created a retention department. I was leading that, and that was a lot of fun, and also a great surface area to work with, because if you can improve retention even a little bit, you know, that compounds over time. We were able to improve it by something like 5 percentage points over a year, which does compound really nicely over a longer term. I think they already had kind of, as I say, because of this, because they really like worked well with SEO, and got the content really quite nicely indexed pretty early on. There was a ton of traffic there, so I'd say acquisition was not the hardest part. We never did in those days any paid acquisition at all, because we also weren't monetizing back then, so didn't
That's
really
what I was
make
a, say. Yeah, I never saw a SoundCloud ad those days. In those days,
it just would not have. We'd have had to spend so much money to make a significant, you know, increase versus you know, over
on
the organics that we had.
Getting, yeah.
We also had like crazy great virality, mostly because the nature of the great content, but also because the team at SoundCloud, you know, and again before my time, I can't take credit for that, but they really built some really great like widgets, player widgets for like Facebook, Twitter, stuff like this. So really nice social network integrations made the content really shareable. Of course, we built out built that out further to capitalize on sort of mobile sharing. But the virality was already there in the product, and that's pretty unusual for any product. And it's definitely a luxury to work on growth with a viral product for sure.
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah, I was going to say just before you mentioned it, Andy, because they didn't actually, SoundCloud didn't monetize for quite a long time, did they?
It's correct. It was not till about 2014, 15, something like this.
Mm. Wow. And around the same, well, no, I guess, are we talking around kind of 2011? When you're talking now, the stories that you're kind of talking about when you joined?
Yeah, I think 2012, 2013 when we were, the kind of period that I'm mostly referring to, 2013, 2014.
So the early days of Spotify as well. I'm assuming that was seen as like the big competitor, or completely different in terms of the kind of the catalogs?
Yeah, it's interesting. The catalog is very different. In those days, actually, it was more diverse between SoundCloud and Spotify, in that SoundCloud didn't have a lot of the major label content that Spotify had, at least not officially. You know, there might have been bootleg versions and things like that. And Spotify had none of the user gen content which SoundCloud had. And they've both kind of merged a little bit closer together in terms of, like, Spotify now has opportunity for creators to get their stuff on there fairly easily. And SoundCloud now has all the major label content through the license deals that they did with the major labels. So I think they've come a lot closer together. Back then, I think for the casual listener who just wanted to listen to some music, yes, Spotify was definitely a big competitor. And YouTube, actually. I think for the sort of music aficionado who wanted to go really deep on a particular genre, or to find, like, hard to find remixes and things like that, I think SoundCloud had an audience there that was quite unique.
There is a story linked to the music I consume, which is a lot of that originated from SoundCloud, actually, back in those days. There's a guy who created a label, I guess, or like a community called Selection. A guy called Joe Kay, who had a weekly show on SoundCloud for like years from the early days. And that thing became so huge that now he's got a weekly show on Apple Music. That made me move on Apple Music. And now he's like big time in LA, DJ, curator. He's got like a label with artists signing on. That came from like him just being in his bedroom every week, releasing a mix of like rare like remixes of like soul, jazz, hip hop kind of music.
Very cool.
And it's like that's one of many success stories of but that's one that I've really like connected to, because nowadays a show in London of him coming with like a few DJs, I almost always go. And that originated from like the early 2010s, I guess.
Amazing. Yeah, I think that there's so many great stories like that, you know, from SoundCloud, from all kinds of genres, all kinds of different kinds of audio and music creators. It was a very inspiring place to work, you know, and the founders, Alex and Eric, I think that built something really special and really amazing that, you know, it's launched so many, you know, thousands of careers in the music industry and beyond, you know, and really helped to surface artists and content that would never have seen the light of day otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. So just to kind of go back, Andy, into the retention side of things, and I know that you have another piece, like another framework that's based around the retention kind of learnings that you started up from SoundCloud. What is that kind of based around? What were the main things that you've carried forward from everything you did at SoundCloud to the recommendations you make to clients today in terms of retention?
Great. That's a big question. So I'll try to break it down a bit, but I may well go off on a tangent. So feel free me back. But so you started just speaking about, I think the framework you're probably referencing is the RRF framework, reach, relevance, and frequency. Yeah, this is something that came very much, very specifically from the learnings of SoundCloud. I think I only sort of put that into a framework or a sort of a model. It's basically just a formula, like reach times relevance times frequency equals impact. So compared to the mobile growth stack, which has a lot of components and things, RRF is relatively simple. But it was nevertheless really important learnings from when we built the notification system that I mentioned earlier at SoundCloud, and when we were sort of developing different kinds of notifications to let users know about, you know, something that's happened on the platform. They weren't all content related. There was also, you know, it's a social platform, so it's also mm-hmm. things like somebody's liked your track if you're a creator, you know, mm-hmm. or you know, somebody's reposted your track, or various other kind of interactions. Basically, we built, I think, around about 10 different notification types. And it was kind of from that experience that, and just seeing how they performed and the impact on retention, that I realized that, you know, this is something probably worth sharing and kind of codifying a little bit, because I think particularly when you're building a product and you look at notifications as just sort of a core part of the product, you know, you could also have like transactional notifications that are maybe letting you know something that's quite important. Like, let's say it's an airline app, you've got like a gate change on your air ticket. That's a useful notification to get, but it's not really a growth centric notification. It's not going to drive, it's not meant to drive like a shit ton more engagement. It's just meant to make people not miss their flights, you know, so it's very valuable, but it's not going to move the needle for growth, right? And so RRF is really a formula for like thinking about like how to prioritize building the kind of notifications, and you can think about this a bit broader than just notifications. Actually, you can think about it in terms of just user interactions or growth initiatives, to think about the surface area that they're going to reach in terms of the addressable audience. And so here I'm talking really about the kind of segment size that's likely to receive any one particular version of this notification. Now, it might be that it's quite dynamic in terms of the segment size, but still that, like, I'll give a concrete example here. It might make it a bit easier. Yeah. If you're targeting users like early in the funnel, or just sort of like something which is going to be applicable to most users because it's relating to a feature or some of their usage in the content which almost everybody uses, then, you know, those notifications have a very high reach. If you're notifying someone about a sort of a power user feature, you know, like maybe it's like an admin control feature or something. If you're like a group admin in Reddit, you maybe get different notifications than if you're mm-hmm. a regular user. You know, there's a relatively small number of those users. They're very valuable. Doesn't mean you shouldn't build notifications for them. But if you want to like build for like general engagement and retention, they're not the notifications that you should build first, because they're not going to move the needle significantly just on the basis of just the reach, right? Reach is a really important thing, which people often forget when they're just building a notification that could be relevant or interesting. And that comes to relevance, which is the next part. Relevance can be roughly, I mean, relevance is something we strive for in all of our work at Feature, and what every marketer and product developer should be striving for. It's kind of like the holy grail, really, of building any experience for the user. And what ultimately is going to drive engagement is delivering a relevant experience to that user, right? So then we take that into the notification territory. You know, you're going to see how relevant your notifications are by how many people are responding positively to them, ideally clicking on them if it's a push notification, right? If they respond very negatively to them and they start opting out or deinstalling the app, then you can probably conclude that notification was very irrelevant to that user. And if you send too many irrelevant notifications, it's going to really piss people off. But it's a sliding scale, obviously. But like you're, you know, so in order to build a successful notification, you ideally want to reach like, you know, a large proportion of the active user population, or the inactive user population, if it's reaching them on a channel that you can reach them on. It needs to be a relevant message. Relevant in the case of SoundCloud would be something like, you know, it's either directly affecting that user. So you've got a new message is a very highly relevant notification, but it's basically a one-to-one, right? You can only send it to the person who's received the message. Yeah. Kanye West has just released a new track, has very high reach and very high relevance to the 5 million followers that Kanye West had on SoundCloud, right? We could send 5 million of those notifications all at once and know that, like, if we send them only to his followers, that's very high relevance. Then you could, like, look at, like, a layer below that, people who'd listened to a Kanye West track in the last 2 weeks. If you wanted to broaden the reach even further, you'd have a slightly lower relevance with that group, but it would still be fairly relevant and still likely get a positive, you know, overall impact. And then the final part is frequency. How often can you send that notification, you know, without the user being pissed off, and whilst it's still being relevant? And so new content recommendations on SoundCloud were a goldmine for all three of those, because we, you know, we could map content to, you know, new content that artists were uploading to people who would be interested in that content, hence getting the reach and the relevance. And there was loads of content coming out onto the platform all the time. So there was a constant supply of things to, you know, to drive a high frequency for that notification. So that was by far and away the big retention driver for SoundCloud.
Sorry, Andy, sorry, carry on.
No, sorry, please continue.
No, I was just going to say that it's, what's the kind of best way to balance these, right? Because in the Kanye West example you gave, you can dial up and down that reach by saying, is it just to the fans? Is it to the 2 week listeners? Is it 3 week listeners? So you could always, well, maybe not always, but you could sometimes end up always skewing towards the highest reach audience that you could send that notification to. I'm assuming there's a balancing act there somewhere.
Yes, there is. And I'd say it's more of an art than a science, but the data will definitely guide you. And, you know, the more you increase that reach and the, you know, there's a tension between these three. It's not exactly a seesaw because there's three variables, right? So it's more like a triangle on a 3D plane or something like this. I'm not sure. I don't have the right geometrical analogy, but it's, you know, it's a balancing act, right? You increase one and it's going to decrease another. And so particularly with reach and relevance, that's typically the case, right? You can't send a message on broadcast to everybody in your entire user base and expect it to be relevant to all of them. This is like very old school email marketing would do this. You just do a blast, you know, like, and you know, that's really not tolerated anymore by the savvy consumer. I'm not sure it was ever really appreciated. You know, and the data will guide you because, like, you know, ultimately for me, and I'm maybe a little bit of a purist in this case, I would say it's worth it as long as your net result is positive, as in, like, you know, if you're net engaging more users than you're pissing off, and your growth is going up and your retention's going up rather than down because people are not leaving the platform out of, you know, irritation. And you're not destroying the channel by having people opting out of that channel. You know, you need to keep an eye on these, what I call like negative signals. Otherwise you can do a lot of damage by, like, you know, over flooding a channel. But, you know, I would argue as long as the net effect is positive, then you've got nothing to worry about because your numbers are going to go up and it's just going to scale very nicely. What I see almost all the time is that people get nowhere near that threshold of where they're, like, going to go into negative territory because developers often are very, very anti-notification and, you know, anti-spam, if you like. You know, no one likes spam. But if the number as a growth guy, I would say if the net effect is positive, like, that's what we're aiming for. Like, this is a numbers game, you know, particularly at the scale of tens or hundreds of millions of users. You know, you want to be optimizing for what's going to grow the whole platform. And most people go nowhere near that. They're way too timid with the frequency or the reach.
That's true. It comes from, I don't know where it comes from actually, but there is it's the same for emails. Like, some, depending on where you work before or the size of the company you were before, like, you have these numbers in your head that you're then going to be guided by to set up frequency. That's the question I wanted to ask you actually. If you've seen, like, in the flesh, a too high frequency and the damage they could do, because I agree with you, most people are shy more than too aggressive, and I tend to be on the more aggressive side of things because I'm like, why should be 3 a week or 4 a week? Like, what is, you can't, every business is different. You can't put a number to this. like, yeah. You know, maybe depending on the type of content and the industry it's in, maybe, you know, an email every day is fine. I don't know, you know, maybe two a day, maybe, you know, same for push notification. So I think it goes back to like testing and stuff. But have you seen like some extremes like that in like going too far?
I mean, yes. I mean, I would say like in the early days, TikTok was incredibly aggressive with push notifications. You know, I would say you could argue they went too far, but I mean, like you can't really fault them on their growth trajectory, really. So, you know, but like, yeah. You know, it used to piss me off a bit because they would be pushing a lot of content which was not very interesting for me. So I felt like they didn't really pay too much attention to relevance. I think over time, just through scale and through like the good optimizations they've done on their algorithm, they've managed to improve relevance, you know, through algorithmic means quite a lot. But it felt in those early days it was pretty aggressive. I don't think that's a great example of like, you know, overdoing it though, because I think it's also a great growth story, right? But yeah, I mean, definitely, I think to your point though, Johan, you know, I think when you look at the user base as, you know, as a mass, as a homogenous group, and try to find a number, an ideal number of, you know, anything like the frequency of interaction with the homogenous group of your entire user base, you're never going to get it right, because there is not a single number that represents that whole user base. They're all individuals, right? And so, like, definitely where I feel like where marketing is heading, and certainly where we're heading at Feature, and the way that we're helping our customers to succeed with all kinds of growth initiatives and certainly around messaging, is to, you know, to get increasingly sophisticated around segmentation and dynamic messaging as well, dynamic segmentation and sort of like rule-based stuff. And also to sort of build like self-optimizing systems that, you know, can kind of dial things up and down. Like, you can go even to like a user level, right? And sort of, there's some really interesting tech hitting the market from third parties now, platforms like AMP, which are kind of building kind of real like personalized user engagement and personalized user messaging. But you could also implement that yourself in like a sort of a more regular customer engagement platform, start to look at sort of engagement scoring on an individual user level. You know, if a user responds positively to a message, add one to their score, right? If the user doesn't respond to a message, subtract one to their score. If they go below a certain threshold, put them onto a quieter track. If they're responding and interacting with every message you send them, keep dialing it up until that score starts to level off, you know? And so by building systems like that, you can start to build a more relevant user journey for every single user. And that's, I think, the holy grail is really to build something that's adaptive and responsive and optimally relevant to an individual rather than as the whole group, even a segment.
That makes sense.
Awesome. It's because you kind of think, you're optimizing your kind of general journeys and your flows to, let's just say, CRM in general. Thinking about taking it to that next level where you're individually optimizing everybody, individual's frequency based on their engagements. That's really cool. And I guess more and more important nowadays, because as a channel, let's say push notifications, it's getting easier and easier to destroy that channel, right? Because it's people that the default behavior now is that people disallow notifications. So there's the immediate battle of actually trying to get people to opt in. And it's just one click and it's gone, similar to opting out of a newsletter through the email domain.
Absolutely.
So it does feel like it needs to move to that personalization method before people just are done with push notifications.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jake. There's definitely an increased risk of that. You know, like the platforms over the years, both Android and iOS, have implemented more kind of user friendly features to allow them to opt out of, you know, specific app notifications, like making it easier and easier for them to do that. And I think that's good. I think that's very positive. You know, like if growth marketers are not sending relevant stuff, then they deserve an opt out, frankly. I think one of the ways you can de-risk it as a growth marketer or as a CRM marketer is, of course, to, you know, instead of testing your new campaign or notification with the broad user base, but like take a representative sample, or test with new users. I like to test with new users because they're going to churn anyway, most of them, frankly. Even if your retention's really good, it's probably not much above 50% of new users coming back on, in month one. So they're a great testing ground. They don't have any real expectations of how much you're going to message them, and it's a, you can take a subset of your new users and be, significantly more aggressive in terms of your notification strategy, or, bolder at least. So aggressive is maybe a sort of a diversive term, but you can certainly figure out where those boundaries are before you would scale something out to the general population.
Yeah,
it's a really nice tip, actually. Definitely.
Do you you mention AMP as one of the tools? Is there any others that you've seen that are doing quite well to help you do that?
Yes. So, I mean, I think Braze has been a really great platform for a long time. We brought in Braze at SoundCloud. It was actually my team that brought that in, and we got a lot of value out of it, and we're able to build and extend that platform quite a bit with our own internal systems and get, it's just nice and flexible and robust. And I feel like they're still building out very cool, like, user interaction features, AI predictive stuff. So I'd say definitely they're up there. We see like CleverTap, MoEngage, and a few others that are sort of on the radar, definitely doing good stuff.
Cool. Nice.
I'm a big fan of CleverTap. I used that at a startup 5 or 6 years ago, and they were like the new player in the market, at least in Europe, and their pricing was amazing, and I thought their functionality was brilliant. But it seems like when sometimes you suggest a company that isn't Braze or some of the other big players, is Airship still going?
Yeah, Airship's still around, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, people are like, oh, I want to go with these guys, even though they're charging me $150,000 a year or something.
it's definitely the marketplace there is quite dynamic. You sort of see folks kind of rising and falling, in the vendor space. Like at Feature, we make it our business to be experts and capable of leveraging like all of the tools that we, that are like up to scratch, I'd say in that list that I gave would be definitely include those ones. There are others for sure, but it's also about like the ones that we see most in the marketplace. We want to make sure that we can leverage whatever our clients are using, to the full potential that those platforms have, and help them to extend them where possible as well.
That's cool. I wanted to ask you actually, going a bit outside of the usual push notifications, I've always been curious about apps developing their own widgets for Apple widgets or for Android devices. And I'm wondering, I wanted to ask you because you're the expert, if you've seen some clever ways to use that as a medium for growth in addition to having push notification, having someone on the screen that would be valuable to the user and make you like top. The reason why I like them is because you're top of mind. It could be very useful to have that on your phone. If you can convince your customer to use that on their phone, it's like a constant reminder of you being here. But I haven't seen many applications for them, or maybe like clever ways to use them, maybe for growth. Could be just a retention thing, but I was wondering if you've seen anything, or if that's something that you're focusing on at the moment or not at all.
It's not a focus for us right now. Some of our clients have built widgets in the past and deployed them with different levels of success. I'm going to struggle to answer this one a little bit because honestly, I have not got a great growth story to tell you about widgets, which I think probably tells you something either about my experience or about the growth potential of these widgets. I think there's something about the way that they're surfaced in the operating system that doesn't really lend them to kind of growth hacking or kind of growth techniques. I think that's maybe quite deliberate from Apple. For example, in the case of the Apple widgets, I don't think they want them to be used as a way of, like, you know, kind of annoying the user, to put it, you know, bluntly. Not that I believe growth tactics are about annoying people, but the widgets that I've seen working really well, like on Apple, are the home screen widgets, which they launched quite recently. You know, I really appreciate getting, like, you know, kind of real time limited notification that's kind of permanently kind of, you know, up on my screen when I'm getting food delivered or my taxi's arriving. You know, I think it's really, really valuable product feature that if you have anything that's kind of time sensitive and real time, you should absolutely, like, build that as a kind of a core part of the product experience. But I don't really see it as a growth lever. I have seen, like LifeSum was a client of ours for quite some time. They have a sort of a diet tracking app, and they had a widget on the home screen for, like, kind of keeping track of, like, your water consumption and calories and stuff like that. Again, I think a nice product feature helps to stay top of mind. Tough to actually measure for, like, how much re-engagement it's driving, but I would assume some. But we've just never seen like a runaway growth story out of widgets.
That's a great answer.
I think the way it's I think we'd be hard pressed to find anybody maybe that had one of those stories. And I think it's just, as you said, Andy, that there isn't it's still a difficult thing to get a user to do. I think if you asked 100 iPhone users, do they even know what a widget is or how they put it on their home screen, even though it's even more obvious now with a little plus button, I think they'd be like, what the hell is that? I have no idea. The same with the hold tap, you know, the shortcuts on app icon where you hold it and you get the little menu of shortcuts. I think that's really cool feature, but, like, I'm sorry, the only apps that are going to develop that feature are the ones that have, you know, they're so far in their growth cycle that they're like, we've got some throw some guys on this thing because it's just do it for fun. You know, it's the same as when you can change your home screen icon color. It's like those guys have gone past the levels of needing to focus on things that are going to move the needle.
Indeed. But Jake, you touched on a really important point, which I was going to make, but then forgot. But you put it really well. And, like, you know, that's that most iOS users or Android users, you know, don't know how to do these, you know, to add a widget to their home screen. It's a power user feature. So coming back to reach, you know, if you're building for that widget, you're only reaching the power users.
Good point.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I'd say with, like, any feature that's being prioritized in a product build, I think it's so easy to get carried away with the sexy ones. And you're like, we need to have Apple Pay in. And you look at the people that are at the bottom of that funnel, it's like, the 4% of users that are actually converting, you've got the 97% that are at the top that aren't even getting to adding a product to their basket.
Totally.
We need to have a feature that focuses on those guys first.
100%. Although, sorry, just one more point. There is one good reason why you would build a like widget or, you know, support Apple Pay or any of these things. And that's that, you know, if you want to get featured in the App Store, you want to get editorial featuring, then Apple and Google, you know, both of them work more or less the same way. If you're supporting the latest, you know, the latest bells and whistles that they've just released on the operating system, then you've got a much better chance of getting featured.
Yeah, that is a very good point. You got to buy your way into that feature slot with dev time. Andy, we're kind of running low on time, but I would like to discuss feature for a bit.
Yeah, sure.
You guys are specifically, would you say, a mobile growth agency? Is that how you...
Yeah, that's definitely how we've been positioning ourselves. I think, like, over the years, we've broadened out a little bit beyond mobile. So we're working with brands like the Weather Channel, like a major sports league in the US that I can't mention the name of, but, you know, and folks like Adobe and a lot of other brands like Walmart, folks that have websites, maybe they have connected TV apps, they have mobile apps, and they don't want to look at their users as just sort of like only on mobile. So they have touch points beyond mobile, and we're helping them to optimize user journeys and sort of build cohesive relationships with their users beyond just mobile. But absolutely, I think it's fair to say that, you know, we're very well known for being a mobile growth agency, and we definitely have, you know, starting with my 20 plus years of experience in mobile, like, we have mobile at the core of everything that we do, and we're kind of known as being mobile experts.
And what's the common, or at the moment, what is the common issue that you see or stumbling block or challenge in mobile that everybody's trying to overcome?
Well, I think one of the big challenges that everyone's still struggling with, sort of on the acquisition side, is all of the privacy regulation. You know, starting with Apple with their ATT and SK Ad Network scan kind of rollout. That's been causing a lot of headaches for particularly the less sophisticated marketers, but I'd say even the more sophisticated ones. Just everybody has to get used to a decrease in precision in measurement, and that's coming to Android pretty soon as well. It's debatable exactly how soon, but rumored to be this year. Basically, the old ways of like being able to attribute every single user and everything that they did back to a specific ad campaign or creative, those days are kind of gone. And now there's more sort of probabilistic methods being used. There's still a lot of uncertainty on the best ways to approach measurement, which is causing a lot of headaches. But I'd say to flip that into a slightly more kind of positive story, I think that people are starting to see increasingly the value of collecting and leveraging effectively first-party data. That's definitely something that we're helping a lot of our customers to appreciate. Is first-party data in all its forms is kind of the new gold, as far as I'm concerned, for growth.
Yeah.
That can be qualitative as well as quantitative, but like there's a lot of quantitative data that you can gather and use and process and then activate in your growth activities. That you can gather that doesn't come from any kind of third-party ad network or anywhere else. You can survey users within your app to ask them questions, which is a fairly low sophistication method, but still very valuable and very underused in our experience. Various things you can do with your leveraging your better understanding of user to build a more personalized and relevant experience and interactions with that user. And that a lot of that doesn't require you to be, getting lots of third-party data, which frankly probably shouldn't have been available in the first place. Like I don't mind that things are coming back towards a slightly more privacy-centric model for the consumer. I think that's good for the industry in the long run.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny because all of us have now lived through this, like the mobile advertising attribution / tracking bell curve. We're now on that kind of downward slope, so much so that in a few years, or maybe even now, you get people coming into their first job as like an exec for a marketing agency. They're like, you used to be able to do what? Back in the day. And that's literally like 3 years ago. I remember when me and Yo worked at a Facebook marketing partner, we had a direct access to the data brokers like Experian or something like that. And you could just call them up and you could say, I want an email list of everyone that's used a credit card in Las Vegas casino in the last 30 days. And then you just run an ad campaign to those people. It's absolutely ridiculous, but it's crazy. So everybody's struggling with that, obviously. Mm-hmm. Is your general suggestion that you just need to accept that you're not going to have that level of precision and put that to one side and not necessarily strive to find some kind of hack or some weird way around it and just get on with life as it is now because it's not changing?
Yes, I think people have to adapt. I think folks need to adapt their measure. It's not that you can't measure stuff anymore. It's just that you have to get used to working maybe with a sort of a different level of precision, as I mentioned, maybe a mix of different approaches, which are going to give you different kinds of views on what's going on. You know, like even when you had attribution that was really precise, like, and precise is, I'm using finger air quotes here because it's like, there was still definitely issues with attribution and that it was never maybe as precise as people expected. And I think there was maybe a false sense of security that people had believing that it was like, some kind of like really, really hard truth. I think actually one of the really positive things is that it actually encourages people to look at maybe the ROI of different marketing activities through things like media mix modeling, for example, or marketing mix modeling. You can look at also the impact of your retention activities also on your sort of overall growth. And look at things a little bit more in an integrated fashion and across the funnel rather than just focusing so much on your acquisition. So, I think it's people have to adapt. The old way is not coming back. And I think if you find a hack, maybe you can get some short-term advantage there, but it's it's not going to be something which is going to, you know, be available. It's not something I would build a business on.
No.
Great.
No, definitely. And if there's someone listening to this right now and they're launching a mobile app and they are thinking, how the hell am I going to grow this thing? I know this is a very difficult question to answer. Where are the initial areas do you think that every app needs to cover off in those kind of first year or so to get the good bedrock and foundation for mobile growth?
Yeah, that is a really big question. But you know, you're talking about product market fit, basically, right? This is a super interesting challenge. It's not the one that the feature really addresses. We generally come in mm-hmm. a little bit later in a product's life cycle where there's already some traction and we're helping teams to get more systematic and more data driven about scaling their kind of next phase of growth. But product market fit's a really interesting question. We could do another whole podcast on this. But you know, in a nutshell, I'd say a few tips on that would be, you know, first of all, don't strive too much for benchmarks. It's great if you can get, if you've got friends in, you know, with a similar kind of app or, you know, sort of competitors who are not super aggressively competitive and they're willing to share, you know, information, that's a good lead. But, you know, don't look too much about what everyone else is doing, but like look at your own numbers and see how you can develop those. You know, product market fit is a two-way street. It's like you've got to optimize your product and your marketing and, you know, literally create that fit, right? So it's about experimenting a lot with audiences to try to understand, you know, where your audience is that really appreciates the product, whilst simultaneously iterating on the product to make it more sticky with those audiences and sort of building that kind of, you know, two-edged knowledge that hopefully meets in the middle with, like, you know, a sort of a decent retention curve for at least, you know, some cohorts of users who are, you know, you're acquiring from, you know, traffic sources that you look like you can probably scale. There's a lot of moving parts there. You know, it's a very tricky topic, but yeah. I would say also just do, like, I think one thing that we still see a lot of folks kind of failing to do for various reasons, but that's just talk to users all the time, talk to potential users in your target audience. Like, in that first year, you need to develop a really, really good understanding of, like, why people would use your product, why people wouldn't use your product. Like, you know, where do these people live? What do they do? What other products are they using? You know, both digital and offline. You know, like, you need to really build these, a rich understanding of your user personas and to then really build and test, like, how to talk to those users, both in the product and outside of the product, in a way that engages them and yeah, back to that term relevance, like, to, you know, to build a relevant conversation and a relevant experience for them. And then ideally you wanted to figure out how to monetize it. I wouldn't leave that as long as SoundCloud did.
Yeah, it's good just to add another headache into the mix of things to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like, big lesson learned from SoundCloud is it's very difficult to make people pay for a product once they've started using it and expecting it for free, you know? So if you're planning to have a subscription in your product, get a basic subscription in there from day one. I think also that gives you a great signal. If people are paying for it early on, then you're probably on the right track to product market fit.
Yeah, it's a good point. We had a discussion with Steve P. Young from AppMasters, who I'm sure you know of.
Yeah, I love Steve.
And we had the same discussion about not leaving it too late, because nobody wants to pay for something that they've had for free. That's a great shout.
Yeah,
definitely. All right.
Awesome.
I think that's it. I think we've come to the hour. Was there anything else you wanted to add, Andy? Maybe like, where can people find you?
Sure. Yeah. And thank you very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
Same.
People can find me on LinkedIn. It's Andy Carvell. I guess you can put this in the show notes. You can find Feature if you need help with mobile growth. You know, we can support with organic and paid acquisition, engagement, retention, both strategy and execution in all markets. That's Feature with a PH. So PHITURE.com. And yeah, you can reach us there via the contact form or hit us up at info@feature.com. And we'd love to hear from anyone if you want to chat about anything we've I've raised today. Give us a bell.
Amazing.
And definitely check out the mobile growth stack.
And yeah, you can check out the Mobile Growth Stack. There's a whole resources section on feature.com. You know, we're big into knowledge sharing. We also have a couple of Mobile Growth Slack communities, by the way, Mobile Growth Stack Slack and ASO Stack Slack, which is all about App Store optimization. Again, you'll find those in the resources section of the website.
Amazing.
Yeah. Andy, that was awesome. We could have carried on for a long time, but we've learned our lesson that it's stop at the hour and be brutal, otherwise they just go on too long.
Yeah, fair enough. Chatting, guys.
We'll bring you back for more in a few months.
I would love to come back anytime you want me.
Yeah. No worries.
Amazing. Thank you. That was awesome, Andy. Thank you so much. Indeed. And we will speak very soon, and we'll get this out soon, and I think deliver a lot of value for people.